Good morning. Turn with me, if you would, to the book of Luke, chapter 19. In a few moments, we'll consider verses 41 through 44. Luke 19, 41 through 44. As you turn to this passage, please recall that at this point, Jesus is entering the final week of his earthly ministry. For the past 3.5 years, he has gone out to the lost sheep of the house of Israel and has preached a message of peace, of repentance, and of salvation. He has fulfilled messianic prophecy after prophecy. He's performed miracles that confirmed his identity as the Son of God. Yet, by and large, the Jewish public, and in particular the Jewish leadership, had rejected his messiahship. They had turned him aside. In verse 41, we find Jesus drawing near to Jerusalem, and we're told that he comes here to Jerusalem from Jericho at the beginning of chapter 19. He passes through Bethphage and Bethany and approaches Jerusalem from the southeast. He descends the Mount of Olives on riding on a colt as his disciples cry out, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." But amidst these shouts of joy and acclamation, when Jesus sees the city set on 5 hills, when he sees the temple sitting upon Mount Zion, which would have been very clear from the road he was taking, he begins to weep. And why does he weep? Read verse 42. "If you had known, even you, especially in this day, this your day, the things that make for your peace, but now they are hidden from your eyes. For days will come upon you when your enemies will build an embankment against you, around you, surround you and close you in on every side and level you and your children within you to the ground. And they will not leave in you one stone upon another because you did not know the time of your visitation." The Messiah prophesied by God since the days of Adam and Eve's fall through the time of Moses, the judges, the kings, even the captivity, and on to the second building of Jerusalem, had arrived. Yet as we're told in John chapter 1, verse 11, he came to his own, and his own did not receive him. Because of this obstinate rejection, because the Jewish people did not know the day of their visitation, as Jesus himself says, Jerusalem and the Jewish nation would be destroyed. Beginning in 66 AD, the Jews rebelled against the Roman Empire, and in response, in 70 AD, the Roman general Titus came to Jerusalem, laid siege for 5 months, and destroyed the city. Jesus, knowing this, knowing what would happen in less than 40 years, laments and mourns for his brethren, for his city, and his nation. Let's fast forward just a few days and turn over to the book of Matthew, chapter 23, and consider verses 37 through 39. Matthew chapter 23, verses 37 through 39. When he enters Jerusalem, the first thing he does is he goes to the temple and he cleanses the money changers, those who sold doves, sheep, and oxen, and says, "My house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves." His authority to do this is questioned, to which Jesus poses the question, was John's baptism from heaven or from men? They were unable to answer this question. He then teaches them the parable of the wicked vine dressers, which they understand points back to them. And then in Matthew chapter 23, Jesus pronounces upon them what are known as the 7 woes, condemning the hypocrisy of the Jewish leadership, condemning all the horrible things that they had done, not only to themselves, but to the very nation which they were chosen to lead. And how he concludes these comments is what I want to focus on in verses 37 through 39. It's almost as if he picks up from Luke 19 and continues this lamentation for his people. He says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children as a hen gathers her chicks, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. For I say to you, you shall see me no more till you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Prophet after prophet had been sent to the Jewish people. Most of them they killed very brutally. They stoned. They were sawn in two. Horrible things. And so finally God sent to them his only son. And they would crucify him as well. Jesus speaks of God's care for his concern for the people, talking about gathering them, holding them as a hen protects her chicks. And yet they rejected him. They rejected that comfort, that protection. They were not willing. And as a result, verse 38, their house is left desolate. In other words, God was going to abandon them as his people. The physical nation of Israel would no longer be the people of God. He would choose a new nation, a spiritual nation, which we understand to be the church. And notice how Jesus concludes his comments in verse 39. You shall see me no more. Until when? Until they say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In other words, you will see me no more until you are willing to recognize that I am the Lord and that I am in fact the Messiah who was sent to you. I'm going away for a time, but I will return, and when I return, you will recognize me for who I truly am. Jesus concludes these comments to the Jewish leadership in chapter 23. In the first verse of chapter 24, we see him with the disciples exiting the temple. And the disciples, of course, were enamored with the buildings of the temple. And if we can believe the reports of Josephus and other historians that have described the temple to us, we know that it was a magnificent structure filled with beautiful things. It was the symbol of the Jewish identity. And you can almost hear the disciples pointing around saying, look, Master, look at this, or look over here, look at that. Isn't this beautiful? Isn't this magnificent? This is the house of God. Notice what Jesus says in verse 2. Do you not see all these things? Assuredly, I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down. Imagine for a moment that you were a Jew from Galilee who had grown up your entire life being told that this was the house of God. You'd come here 3 times a year if you were from a faithful family to worship God. You were proud. You were pleased that God had chosen your nation to be his people. This was part of who they were. And you can imagine a statement like what Jesus makes here, that this temple was going to be destroyed, how that would affect them. It would shake you to your very core. You would want to know more. And so, later on, when they're in private, the disciples come to Jesus at the Mount of Olives in verse 3. We're told in another passage, it was Peter, Andrew, James, and John. And they ask him 3 questions in verse 3. And it's those 3 questions that I want to consider this morning, and God willing, this evening with you. The first question they pose to him is, tell us, when will these things be? When will these things be? In other words, when will the temple be destroyed? Those 2 words, these things, go back to verse 2. Do you not see all these things? Jesus is talking about the temple. So what do the disciples want to know? They want to know, when will the temple be destroyed? That's question number 1. Question number 2. What will be the sign of your coming? And to me, that goes back to what Jesus says in chapter 23, verse 39. You will see me no more until when? Until you're willing to say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. In other words, Jesus has told not only his disciples, but the entire Jewish nation that he's going away for a time, but that he will return. And so the disciples, knowing that this man was filled with signs himself, want to know, what will be the sign of that return? When will you come back? And finally, the 3rd question, what will be the sign of the end of the age? This final question was tied into what the Jews believed concerning the end of time and how that would play out when it came to the Messiah. They believed the Messiah coming to the temple and reigning there would signify the end of the world, that a new age would come about. And so Jesus' return in triumph to them pointed to this end of time, this end of the age, if you will. It's my understanding that in the 24th and 25th chapters of the book of Matthew, Jesus answers these three questions. And he begins in verses 4 through 29 answering question number 1. He also talks about it in 32 through 34 as well. Question 2, he answers in verses 30 and 31. And as I understand it, question 3 is answered in verses 35 and following. This is what we will consider this morning and this evening. Let's pick up with verse number 4. In verses 4 through 15, Jesus begins to answer this first question. When will these things be? In other words, when is the temple going to be destroyed? And he offers to the disciples 9 indicators that will precede the destruction of the temple. The first indicator we find in verses 4 and 5. Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. The first indicator would be the appearance of false Christs. The Jewish people recognized that Rome was the fourth empire in the succession of empires mentioned in Daniel chapters 2 and 7. And they knew, based on Daniel chapter 2, verse 44, that it was in the days of this fourth empire, in the days of the Roman Empire, that God would establish a kingdom that would never falter, that would never be destroyed, and would in fact consume all other kingdoms. Daniel 2:44. And in the days of these kings, the fourth kingdom, the Roman Empire, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. They were expecting this kingdom to arrive during this time. The Roman Empire had occupied them for well over 100 years. They expected the arrival of the Messiah and the establishment of this kingdom. And so they were looking for the Messiah. But as we're told in Acts chapter 5, verses 35 through 37, men had risen up claiming to be Messiahs, but were found to be false. In Acts chapter 5, verses 35 through 37, the Jewish teacher Gamaliel refers to these false Christs, and he says this, Men of Israel, take heed to yourselves what you intend to do regarding these men. For some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody. A number of men, about 400, joined him. He was slain, and all who obeyed him were scattered and came to nothing. After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the census and drew away many people after him. He also perished, and all who obeyed him were dispersed. False messiahs had been appearing in Judea since the beginning of the Roman occupation. They were expecting this, and men rose up claiming to be the Messiah. Yet when they were confronted with the Messiah, they were unable to recognize him because they expected something different. According to the historian Josephus, the land of Israel during this time was overrun with magicians, with seducers and imposters, who drew the people after them in multitudes into solitudes and deserts to see the signs and miracles which they promised to show by the power of God. And we see in the decade preceding Jerusalem's destruction, this rose to a fever pitch. Men rose up claiming to be messiahs, but as Jesus warns us, or warns the disciples in Jerusalem, I should say, do not believe them. Do not believe their reports. The second indicator we find in verse 6, this indicator of wars and rumors of wars. Nation will rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. In my estimation, the rebellion which took place in the Jewish state preceding the destruction of Jerusalem fits this quite nicely. The seeds of the Jewish rebellion were laid by the Roman Emperor Caligula. Caligula declared himself to be a god and decided that a statue of himself should be placed in every temple throughout the Roman Empire so the people could worship him as a god. Well, you can imagine how the Jews reacted when they tried to put a statue of Caligula in the temple in Jerusalem. They were not happy with this. We also see rebellion being sown by how the Roman governors treated the Jewish people. They would go into the temple treasury and they would confiscate money from the temple treasury, take it for themselves. This made the Jewish people mad. And so what we see in this decade preceding the destruction of Jerusalem is these seditious conditions, this rebellion, this revolution taking place. Here are some of the things that happened. At Masada, a group of Jews surrounded a Roman garrison, convinced them to disarm, and then slaughtered them in cold blood. I should say that these groups of Jews thought that they were going to bring back the Messiah by doing this. We also see that Gentiles in Palestine were not reacting well to the Jewish rebellion as well. In Caesarea, Gentiles slew 20,000 Jews in one day. In Damascus, 10,000 Jews were massacred while others were sold into slavery. All of Palestine and Judea leading up to this year, AD 70, was sunk in civil war. And by 68, the Jewish revolution controlled most of Judea and Palestine. We see in the Roman Empire further upheaval as well. In the space of 18 months, four different emperors were assassinated by their successors. Four emperors in 18 months. The Roman historian Tacitus says at this time, it was full of calamities, horrible with battles, rent with seditions, savage in peace of itself. Wars and rumors of war. The third indicator, famines, pestilences, and earthquakes. We find that in verse 7, and there will be famines, pestilences, and earthquakes in various places. Four times between the years 41 and 54 A.D., four separate times, famine struck Rome, Greece, and Palestine. Four times in the space of 15 years. In 40 A.D., Babylonia was struck with a plague that killed thousands. Rome was struck with a plague in 66 A.D., and earthquakes occurred in the following places in these years leading up to Jerusalem. And listen to this list. Rome, Laodicea, Hierapolis, Colossae, Pompeii, Smyrna, Miletus, Chios, and Samos. All these cities were struck by earthquakes leading up to these days. They were surrounded by famines, pestilences, and earthquakes. Indicator number 4, the persecution of Christians. We find that in verse 9, that they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. We see the early church going through persecution, beginning in Acts chapter 7 and 8 with the stoning of Stephen. Then continuing on in Acts chapter 8 as the church is scattered abroad and goes out preaching the gospel. We see persecution taking place as Paul goes out among the Gentile provinces and begins preaching the gospel to people. But on an imperial level, as far as the Roman Empire was concerned, persecution did not begin until 64 AD with the Roman Emperor Nero. In 64, Nero decided that he needed a new palace built in Rome, as the story goes. Needing to clear out some space, he decided to set a fire, and as a result, much of Rome was burnt down. Nero needed to find someone to pin the blame on for this fire, so he chose this small group of people called Christians. And this is what Tacitus has to say about what resulted from Nero's accusations. Nero found a set of profligate and abandoned wretches who were induced to confess themselves guilty. And on the evidence of such men, a number of Christians were convicted. Not indeed on clear evidence of having set the city on fire, but rather on account of their sullen hatred of the whole human race. They were put to death with exquisite cruelty, and to their sufferings Nero added mockery and derision. Some were covered with skins of wild beasts and left to be devoured by dogs. Others were nailed to crosses. Numbers of them were burned alive. Many covered with inflammable matter were set on fire to serve as torches during the night. Persecution rose to a new level prior to the destruction of Jerusalem in 64 A.D. The fifth indicator that Jesus offers is what he calls his betrayal of one another. Betrayal of one another. You can imagine as a Christian having to go through persecution what that would cause some people to do. Unfortunately, according to Jesus' testimony, some even within the body would betray their brothers and sisters, would turn them over to the authorities to go through these torturous acts. Jesus says in Luke chapter 21:16, in the parallel account to this, that this would even extend in families as well. That brothers would turn in brothers. That girls would turn in their fathers and others such as this. Yet such acts were not just happening within the church. This was happening in the Jewish nation as well. The Jewish nation was not only turning against Rome, it was turning on itself. They were fighting amongst themselves and with the Roman Empire. This is best exemplified by the religious group, the Zealots. You'll remember that one of Jesus' apostles was a Zealot, Simon the Zealot. He's also called Simon the Canaanite. The Zealots were a political group who were bent on ousting the Roman occupation. They wanted to remove the Romans out of Judea. And so all their efforts were put toward this end. Prior to the siege, they were largely in control of Jerusalem, and they encouraged their countrymen to remain in Jerusalem, though they were beset by this incredible army led by Titus. They encouraged them to remain in Jerusalem because God was going to deliver them. That's what they said. That's how they kept them there. They promised deliverance, and all they found was death. The Zealots also pledged to execute any Jew who cooperated with the Roman authority. They assassinated people in public by coming up to them and stabbing them in the back and then running away. They were turning on one another. It wasn't simply them fighting against the Romans. It was the Jews fighting against themselves. They betrayed one another. The sixth indicator was that false prophets would abound. We know false teachers and false prophets threatened the early church. Last year we studied the book of 2 Peter and we looked at chapter 2. I believe Jim Pride taught that chapter about false teachers and false prophets. The book of Jude is also an excellent example that false teachers and false prophets threaten the early church. But we also see false prophets rising up in the nation of Jerusalem, or the nation of Judea as well. The ruling authorities in Jerusalem would set up false prophets in order to control the population. They thought that by putting these men up, they could best encourage people to remain in Jerusalem. If they had these men claiming to be prophets and saying, God will deliver us, stay here, then they could keep everyone in Jerusalem. And this is, in fact, what they did. According to Josephus, the tyrannical zealots who ruled the city suborned many false prophets to declare that aid would be given to the people from heaven. This was done to prevent them from attempting to desert and to inspire confidence in God. As such, false prophets were not only a danger to the early church, but also to the Jewish nation as well. Indicator number 7. The love of many will grow cold. You can imagine how this would happen within the church. If you're going through intense periods of persecution, if you're going through extremely difficult times where people were turning on one another, you can see how love might grow cold. In Revelation chapter 2, when Jesus is talking to the church at Ephesus, he cites that Ephesus had stood firm against false teachers, that they had stood steadfast for the faith. And yet, what were they brought up short about? Their love. They had left their first love. They had lost their love for one another. Love will grow cold if we're not careful in times of difficulty. And love growing cold was also evident in the Jewish nation as well. Let me read you a quotation from Josephus. He was describing the siege and the conditions during the siege, and he had this to say. A woman of distinguished rank, having been plundered by the soldiers, in hunger, rage, and despair, killed and roasted her own babe, and had eaten one half of it before the deed was discovered. If that's not love growing cold, I don't know what it is. Killing and roasting your own baby because you were hungry and mad. The love of many will grow cold. The eighth indicator, the gospel will be preached to the whole world. This we find in verse 14. And the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Jesus commissioned the apostles in Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20, to do this very thing. They were to take the gospel out to all nations. And as Mark records in Mark chapter 16, they were to teach it to every creature under heaven. This was their commission. This is what they were to do. And according to Colossians chapter 1, verse 23, this had been achieved by AD 70. In Colossians chapter 1, verse 23, Paul has this to say. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard, which was preached to every creature under heaven, of which I, Paul, became a minister. It is my firm belief that Paul, speaking by the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, was convinced that the gospel had in fact been preached to the entire world, as he says, to every creature. How this happened, we do not know. But let me remind you of a few facts. Number one, in Acts chapter 2, remember there were 16 different ethnic regions represented in Acts chapter 2. You had people from the Medes, from the Persians. You had people from up in Asia Minor. You had people from as far away as Rome. You had people from as far away east as beyond the Tigris and Euphrates River. You had people also from Ethiopia, as we see the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts chapter 8 going home from Jerusalem having been to a feast. How the gospel spread to the whole world, we're not sure. History does not record this. But I am convinced, based upon Paul's inspired statement, that this had in fact occurred. And Jesus says that the gospel will have been preached to the whole world prior to the destruction of Jerusalem. 8 indicators so far, and finally the 9th, as promised in verse 15. This thing that Jesus calls the abomination of desolation. This is referred to in Daniel's 70 weeks prophecy in Daniel chapter 9, the abomination which makes desolate. And Jesus gives this as the final indicator of Jerusalem's destruction. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. There it is. There's the final thing. All these things have taken place, but when you finally see this, then know that the destruction is about to happen. What is the abomination of desolation? Well, if we turn over to Luke chapter 21, verse 20, I think we have an indicator, a very good indicator of what Jesus means by this. In Luke chapter 21, verse 20, and Luke 21 is the parallel account of this prophecy, Jesus says this concerning this final indicator. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. There it is. That's the abomination of desolation. When Jerusalem is surrounded by armies, it's coming. The abomination, as I would understand it, was the fact that Jerusalem was surrounded by a Gentile army. The desolation obviously points to its destruction. This is consistent with what Jesus said back in Luke chapter 19, which we referred to earlier. He talks about them being surrounded by their enemies, an embankment built against them, and then the city would be leveled and everyone within it. The abomination which makes desolate is the surrounding of Jerusalem by the Roman army. The Roman army laid siege to Jerusalem for 5 months, and during the siege, 116,000 dead bodies were thrown over the wall. All Jews within the city were killed. They were given no quarter. They were not spared. Everyone was killed. And the death toll estimates range from 250,000 to 1.4 million, depending on who you read. According to Josephus, 97,000 people who tried to flee from the city were sold into slavery. 97,000. And according to the atheist historian Will Durant, with the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple, he has this to say. Essentially, the destruction of the temple marked the end of the rebellion and of the Jewish state. Very simple. All these things Jesus had warned about. It's interesting when you look at the historical accounts who was given credit for this very thing taking place. The Roman general Titus, when he entered the upper city of Jerusalem, and saw the three great towers of defense that had been built many years before, and he saw how wonderfully they'd been put together, how good they were for the defense of the city, had this to say. We have certainly had God for our assistant in this war, and it was no other than God who ejected the Jews out of these fortifications. For what could the hands of men or any machines do towards overthrowing these towers? Josephus, in reflecting back upon the rebellion and the destruction of Jerusalem, had this to say. O most wretched city, what misery so great as thou didst suffer from the Romans when they came to purify thee from thy intestine hatred. For thou could be no longer a place fit for God, nor could thou longer continue in being, after thou had been a sepulcher for the bodies of thine own people, and had made the holy house itself a burying place in the civil war of thine. Yet may thou again grow better, if perchance thou wilt hereafter appease the anger of that God who is the author of thy destruction. Finally, to close this morning, I'll turn your attention back to the book of Micah, chapter 3, verses 9 through 12. By the mouth of Titus, by the mouth of Josephus, God was declared to be the author of Jerusalem's destruction as prophesied by Jesus. And it's also predicted in prophecy as well. Micah chapter 3, verses 9 through 12. Now hear this, you heads of the house of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, who abhor justice and pervert all equity, who build up Zion with bloodshed and Jerusalem with iniquity. Her heads judge for a bribe, her priests teach for pay, and her prophets divine for money. Yet they lean on the Lord and say, is not the Lord among us? No harm can come upon us. Therefore, because of you, Zion shall be plowed like a field. Jerusalem shall become heaps of ruins, and the mountain of the temple like the bare hills of the forest. If you're here this morning, and Jesus Christ is not your Savior, we offer to you one more invitation. As you can see this morning, Jesus was in fact a prophet sent from God. Everything that he predicted took place. We'll talk about this prophecy some more tonight if you're not convinced. Jesus has offered you the opportunity to come to him and to become a family, member of the family of God. If that is your desire this morning, if you wish to take on Christ, to put him on, and to acknowledge him as your Lord and Savior, then we encourage you to take this opportunity as we stand and sing number 599.